What is up, and welcome to Off the Books, where we're surfing the uncharted waters of accounting, of finance, and wherever else those waves take us. Off the Books is brought to you by Workiva, the number one platform for financial reporting and compliance. Let Workiva handle your risky business so you can get more time to work on your Tom Cruise impression. I'm Drew Dubner. I am your host. I'm not an accountant, but I like asking questions of people who are, so finance professionals can do their jobs better. And today, we've got a Luigi Good show for you. We've got Andy Buck, we've got Ernest Annunciacion, and we've got Matt Lormer. Andy Buck, why don't you tell those fine folks at home who you are?
Yeah, hey, pleased to be back. A lifelong tech enthusiast, a nerd, and a semi-competent Minecraft player, as today we're going to be talking video games.
Ernest?
Yo, what's up, everyone? It's Ernest Annunciacion, your OG CIA resident sneakerhead and self-proclaimed 8-bit video game aficionado. Happy to be back on talking about this topic.
And we've got Matt.
Hi, my name is Matthew Lormore. I'm a senior information security engineer, and I have been playing video games at a computer since I can remember. There's photos of me somewhere doing it at 2 years old, I think.
Excellent. So guys, today we're revisiting an episode that we originally aired back in May about a data breach. And that data breach happened at a third-party vendor of Nintendo, the video game behemoth that you're all familiar with. So the situation back in May was that Broadon, a former third-party vendor of Nintendo's from back in the late 90s, was breached, and a bunch of source code leaked out. For more on that original situation, listener, go back to a previous episode, episode 7. But why are we talking about this exactly now? Because another much larger data breach in Nintendo just happened over the weekend. Much bigger and potentially much worse for the company. So let's set the stage with what we know now. Over the weekend, prototype versions of classic Nintendo games, including Yoshi's Island, Super Mario Kart, and Star Fox, were all leaked onto the internet, including like 10 gigabytes of development data for Nintendo 64 games alone. The data was said to originate from the Broadon server hack that we mentioned back in May, but we still don't really know where it came from right now. And nerds are sifting through all the specs to find the interesting gems. For the Twitter inclined out there, there's some really incredible videos of prototype stuff out there. So go check that out. Matt, did I summarize that okay?
Yeah, I think so. And I think one of the important things to point out here is that unfortunately this isn't an uncommon thing in the world of gaming or video games at all. Fans almost always want more than the developers or publishers are willing to give them. And some of them have the technical chops to go and try and pull that directly from the places they shouldn't illegally. And we've seen this happen before, and I'm going to pick on Valve Software a little bit here because it's some of the biggest ones that I've seen. You know, back in 2003, they had their source code stolen by a German national, and that ended up culminating in this weird back and forth between him and the founder of Valve Software, Gabe Newell, where Gabe was pretending to bring him over for an interview for a job, and they were going to have him arrested when he got onto American soil, but the Germans got to him first in his house, and he ended up going to trial, and it all fizzled out, and Half-Life 2 made a crap load of money, and it didn't end up mattering in the end. And then back in 2013, and this is kind of getting more in line with kind of like meta leaks rather than like the source itself, Valve Software's ticketing system was, parts of it were left open to the public, and a bunch of data got leaked out of that on, like, you know, what games they were working on, what they weren't working on. And it was just, you know, during a time where Half-Life 2 came out, like, you know, 10 years before, however long it had been, and people have been pining for that game forever. It's probably one of the most anticipated video games in history if it ever gets made. And people want all the information they can get on it. And it's just, nobody knows whether it's in development or not. And new titles and installments, the information on those kind of get dumped pretty frequently on, like, if you've ever seen headlines where it's, oh, the new video game in this franchise just got released because, you know, retailer put it up early on their store page or something like that. It's like coordination between the publishers, developers, and the relationships between the companies that actually sell their stuff gets botched, and data information leakage happens that way as well. And a lot of the stuff coming out for Nintendo is kind of older in nature, but it kind of can spell trouble for them in some ways.
One question I'd have for you on the security side. You know, there's sort of the Hollywood version of hacking, and then there's probably the more practical day-to-day sort of aspects of it. With a lot of these hacks and leaked source code, what are sort of the mechanics behind that? Like how do people
Oh
dig
man.
in and get access?
So first I'm going to address the Hollywood hacker thing. Like I think like the community is doing a pretty good job of like trying to dispel like what the actual hackers look like. It's not the guy in his mom's basement most of the time. If you want to watch a show that does a really good job, what is it? Mr. Robot does a
Yeah.
really, really good job of portraying like what it's obviously it's stylized, but I've watched the first season. I haven't gotten the rest of it yet, and that was pretty slam dunk on what it feels like to work in that space. It's not your hooded figure. The one thing Hollywood does get right is there's a large amount of swearing, and that tends to continue to happen. That is a part that they got correct. And as far as the mechanisms that they actually go through to get this data, I mean, it's going to be everything from something super stupid, like I just said, where Valve Software left part of their stuff on the public-facing internet. That's really easy, right? Like that's not hard. Somebody probably just stumbled across it on accident. Or it can be way more complex. Like, in security, we talk about defense mechanisms should be layered. There should never be one thing that is like the keys to the kingdom. It's like every step of the way, it should be just stopping you from getting further. Or if you do get in, your actions can be scoped and the damage can be limited. And when the layering is not set up properly, that's when it can get really bad.
You know, just having spent a lot of time conversing with Ernest over the years, it feels like that's actually similar to kind of the approach that a company might take for risk in general, not just, cybersecurity or security risk. You know, it's also kind of how you might need to evaluate risk across your organization.
Yeah, I think it's not just risk, but you think about the governance structure there. And Lorimer talks about, those layers. So companies have adopted that three lines of defense model, right? To have a good governance structure and infrastructure in place so that, hey, if something does get past the first line, you still have got your second line, which is particularly centered around kind of those compliance functions, and then your third line of defense being internal audit. But that could be a whole nother podcast episode in and of itself.
Well, it's interesting. So I know both of you, and on the GRC side of the house, governance, risk, and compliance, Lorimer actually gets hit up by sales reps in the GRC space trying to sell him GRC solutions. So, like Ernest, you on the auditor side, that then the same kinds of technology could even apply to someone in Lorimer's role on the security side. So it's an odd little parallel between the two of you.
Yep,
Well,
it's an indefinite loop, huh?
these things are when it comes to risk and compliance and some of the more technical aspects of security, it's not they're not black boxes of one another. They interact, and it's kind of above my head on some of it, but a lot of those things interact. That's why we do all the audits we do. The SOX, the FedRAMP authorizations, and a lot of those programs are tailored specifically for testing the layers that you put in place.
Yeah, absolutely makes sense.
That kind of brings us back closer to the risk and accounting topics that was the start of the episode, which is the theme of the show. Ernest, back in our episode in May, you had some good advice for our listeners.
Yeah, before we get to that though, Drew, I think it's time to take a pause for the cause and let's get that first commercial. Somebody's got to pay the bills and keep the lights on.
Hot damn, let's do it. This episode of Off the Books is brought to you by Workiva. Do you remember 1985? I do not, as I was not alive, dear listener. It was a year of new Coke and hair metal. It was also the year the original Super Mario Brothers came out, and it was the year that Microsoft Excel was released. Video games have evolved really, really dramatically since 1985, and so has business, but Excel is roughly the same. Maybe you are mentally connecting dots here. My point is this. Why are you still using software from 1985 for businesses staffed and created by people born after that? It just don't make sense. Introducing Workiva. With a familiar interface, it feels like Excel, but is so much more. Centralize all your vital reporting and risk data in one spot and get rid of those terrible shared drives. This gives you more time to do important stuff, like drink new Coke and play video games and listen to Motley Crue. Yes, Workiva, it is the real thing. That's workiva.com/podcast. And welcome back. Now, Ernest, let's revisit those five steps for successful third-party risk management. Let's roll back that tape from that episode in May.
In my mind, there's kind of five areas when it comes to that third-party risk management process. First is the planning. So once you've identified, hey, here's a potential product or a service that I want to outsource to a third party, what's the plan to manage that relationship? And so you start by identifying, you know, what's the inherent risk profile of that company. You might look at them and check them against like a blacklisted database that the government provides or whatever, right? I mean, looking at the financial stability of the company, there's a huge like risk assessment questionnaire that goes on, especially when you think about these strategic partnerships where you have to rely and have a certain level of trust with that intellectual property, right? And so that's kind of the planning phase. The second phase is due diligence. So before you execute any contract, you know, what are you doing to review those third parties and ensure their qualifications are appropriate and understanding the controls that they have within their environment to mitigate those inherent risks that you identified in the planning phase, right? And those risks that are going to be posed by the relationship. And so one thing that a lot of companies take advantage of are the SOC 2 reports or Service and Organization Controls Report, right? This provides an efficient and effective solution to facilitating what for many companies is a burdensome and very complicated third-party management process. And so that can help actually reduce costs associated with accommodating multiple questionnaires, multiple vendors. I mean, so many different vendors on that. You know, what I love about the SOC 2 reports is that they are audited by a third party on an annual basis. So the company is going to provide the SOC 2 report to their suppliers, to their customers, to whoever wants it, and know that you have kind of that third-party validation through a public accounting firm. The third piece is around the actual contract itself. And here's where you have to delineate the roles and responsibilities of the relationship. Who's going to do what? What access do you get to? You know, including contract clauses that help ensure the contract's enforceability, you know, limiting your company's liability, kind of the indemnification that comes with it, and mitigating disputes about the performance. And so one thing that I've done in the past, when I looked at contracts in my previous life, typically you would include a provision that's called a right to audit clause. And so that gives you the right to either audit part of their operation, maybe get into their IT security, or even looking at their financials. The problem is a lot of companies don't act on that provision, especially for their higher risk vendors. Like it is, in my opinion, it's a standard term and condition that is within any contract template out there. You can go on Google and download one, and I guarantee there's going to be a right to audit clause in there, but people don't use it. And so, you know, I mean, and again, you can make the argument, oh, I don't have time to, you know, go and do that third party audit to hundreds of different vendors. But again, that's where you can rely back on the SOC 2 and maybe just pick the higher risk vendors that are out there. And so the fourth area is around monitoring. So after the execution of the actual contract, you know, ongoing monitoring should include both kind of the risk and performance management of the relationship. So as issues are being identified, you're remediating them, you're escalating them to appropriate decision authorities within the organization. And then ultimately, you've got these contingency plans in place that need to be maintained so that you're ensuring that activities can be transitioned in-house or to another third party in the case that it leads to the fifth phase, which is the termination. So when the contract expires, the terms of the contract have been satisfied or in response to a contract default, or it might be a response to changes in the organization or third party's business strategy, you may have to resort to kind of terminating that contract. And so companies out there need to be sure that they execute against those contingency plans in order to mitigate whatever risk might arise during that termination phase.
Boom. Again, those five steps were: one, plan and research potential vendors; two, do your due diligence; three, write and execute the perfect contract; four, monitor the relationship; and five, terminate that contract responsibly. And listeners, if you're more reading inclined, check the Workiva blog. We're putting out a good article about this in the days to come. You know, Ernest, is there another step needed for something post-contract here? So if step five falls on terminating the contract responsibly, all of this stuff seemed to happen well after Nintendo broke up with Broadon. That was step five. You know, it seems like, is there a need for some sort of post-contract involvement?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that we need to unpack here. And it's interesting that number three, we talk about writing and executing that perfect contract. There's no such thing as a perfect contract. So the first thing is to understand what can actually happen after a contract expires. Most contracts, and I'm not a lawyer by any means, but my understanding is that they're governed by applicable state laws. However, courts to date have typically taken one of three approaches when looking at expired written contracts and the parties continue to perform beyond those termination dates. And the first is the written contract continues to exist beyond that stated termination date for a reasonable amount of time. The second is the written contract is deemed expired, and then the parties will be deemed to have entered into a new contract implied in fact. Or number three, and which is most likely what happened between Broadon and Nintendo, is that no contract exists between the parties. So you basically let it go, it terminates, and then you move on in part ways. So that's the first thing. The second thing is talking about the actual provisions within a contract itself. And so similar to what we're used to in terms of data use provisions within a contract, a company like Nintendo that relies heavily upon third parties for development or delivery of services should consider data protection provisions that will stipulate how proprietary information is to be handled after the conclusion of that contracted project or maybe upon early termination. So while we don't have that actual contract between Nintendo and Broadon, and I wouldn't be surprised if eventually it does show up online for public consumption, I have to assume that given the timing of when they first entered that relationship, that it was a simple oversight by both parties. They're probably thinking, hey, we've got this mutual understanding. We're both working on some sensitive shit here, so let's not f this up, right? But without that term or provision in the contract, there is no way that Nintendo has of requiring Broadon to return that institutional data or otherwise dispose of it in a way that doesn't jeopardize the security or the information of its constituents. And so what I'd recommend is, you know, as you're going through that five-step process and early on as you're generating what that contract would look like, is adding a simple clause that has instructions on how you return proprietary information or sensitive information to the originating company or how you destroy it under the direction of the company that's providing that, and then having subsequent audits, right? So being subject to a follow-up to ensure that those processes and the controls were appropriately performed.
I wish I knew as much as you do about that subject, about literally any subject.
a simple Google search will help, but I've done contract audits in the past, and trust me, they are... You know, I thought about getting like a JD MBA at one point in my career, but then when I saw how much reading was involved with it, and look, I like reading as much as the next person, but when you're reading legal documents, you know, it's easy to fall into a trance and overlook things that if you don't know what to be looking for, you probably will just glean over it. And so
that's why all the good stuff's in the middle.
Exactly. You get it nested in there because most people just pay attention to what's in the beginning and what's at the end. Like you said, Laura Moore, gotta get it nested in there.
Yeah, I hadn't heard I'm not really familiar up on contract law or wording and stuff like that, but I like the idea of having the, like, how do you like return data back? Like, how do you get mm-hmm. rid of that? And that it struck me just because we deal with this a lot. It struck me as like a right to be forgotten clause, like that comes from GDPR, but you're just agreeing to it between the two entities that are agreeing into this contract because you don't want them to retain the data any longer than they would need it to do their jobs, right?
Right. And I think that's a challenge, though, is the process of how do you get that data back? Because if it does, in fact, exist on their servers, does that include, you know, does that introduce additional complexities of getting access to the servers? You know, how do you know that they haven't partitioned it off and there's different segments that, you know, aren't visible to somebody who's even doing an audit? And I think I talked about this in the last episode. one of the easiest clauses that every contract should have is that right to audit the third party. It's one that gets overlooked so commonly, not just overlooked, but doesn't get enforced. They don't enact on that clause. So I have to imagine, again, company like Nintendo, big reliance and dependency on third parties for development of the games and of hardware and accessories, peripherals, you know, it would behoove them to spend some of that money up front and actually go and audit their third parties to make sure that, hey, we are reducing the risk that seemingly is transferred to our suppliers or vendors just because of the nature of the contract that we have in place.
And coming from the financial world, it's crazy to see, but like, you know, we're audited all the time.
Right.
Like, I mean, that clause gets exercised regularly.
And as long as you have a strong controller environment in place, I would assume you welcome that, right?
Yeah. Like, oh, it's right? Yeah. That's, you know, security teams, if they're operating correctly, should be viewing that as an opportunity to find out what's wrong or to flex their muscles.
Exactly.
Like, it's not a don't do this kind of thing.
I'm going to take this as an opportunity to flex my muscles and shut this conversation down. That brings us to the closing question of the day. Let's talk something not about video games for 5 minutes. What's your favorite board game? Do you have a board game of choice? I mean, I've got one. It's obviously Scrabble.
Scrabble?
Scrabble.
Well, yeah, you're a word guy.
I feel like Drew would annihilate me in Scrabble. I'm not even going to try.
Yeah. Now, the best board game ever made, hands down, no question, is Stratego. Although, amusingly, the only time I've ever actually played Stratego is on a computer. So it was like this virtual board game that was on this vintage Mac of ours growing up. And so I got good at it. I, you know, since have played it in real life.
Do they still manufacture Stratego?
I've got a copy. I think I bought a copy at Goodwill a couple of years ago.
It's probably my copy.
I got to go with Settlers of Catan.
Someone was going to do it. Someone was going to say Settlers.
But specifically the Seafarers edition. Not the original version is good as an introduction, but being able to have those additional expansion packs. Many family game nights have been ruined when you layeth the smack it down with a Monopoly card and steal everybody's wheat at the end of the game to bolster your settlements into cities and just, yeah, and then just crush it and get that last victory point.
Annihilation.
So I'm not a big board game guy, but your Catan comment made me remember this, and it's one of my favorite rating scales that I've seen, and I'm sure this is done elsewhere, but we were at a board game cafe in Amsterdam, and their rating system on how hard the games were how many Catans it was. So like we picked up like a 3 Catan game off the shelf, and about 2 minutes in, we decided this was way too hard for all of us. And somebody went to the front and asked for suggestions, and they came back with a half Catan game. And that was just what we needed.
And I Catant believe we've come to the end of the conversation. I'm Drew Dubner. This has been Off the Books. Please subscribe, leave a review, buy me a board game, or tell your buddies if you like the show. Surf's up, and we'll see you on the next wave.